Welcome to McGill and to this very special event, our annual Gewurz Lecture in Urban Design. We would like to thank Mr. Gewurz and Mrs. Gewurz, who is not here though, for their generosity in making this event possible. And we also would like to thank IDEU Québec for partnering with us this evening. C'est un vrai plaisir de travailler avec un autre organisme dans un milieu un peu différent et puis de pouvoir rassembler des gens de milieux différents, en effet, ensemble pour s'intéresser ensemble à quelque chose de très nouveau. We're very happy to see so many of you here. And I would like to ask Mr. Raymond Bouchard for, here at the podium for a moment to say a few introductory words, after which I will introduce the guest speaker and then we will be able to start. Thank you, Mr. Bouchard.
Merci, Monsieur Fischler. You were just saying that it was a pleasure for you to work with UDI as partners for this evening. I must say that it's more than a pleasure for us to be here this evening and work with the McGill University. It is an honor for us, more than a pleasure, to work with you. UDI, the Urban Development Institute of the province of Quebec, represents property owners and developers, also architects, engineers, lawyers, designers, urbanists that work in the province. UDI is more interested to work with McGill University than ever, not only with teachers but with students. We feel that there are great careers ahead of students in the real estate business in the province, as much as in Canada, and we will continue to work with teachers and students of McGill. I'd like to mention the presence of Guy Charron, our president of our board of directors at UDI. Guy Charron is also Executive Vice President, Head of Quebec Operations with Canmark. I don't know if Guy, I don't know where you're sitting, but Guy, if you could maybe just, Monsieur Charron's in the back. I had the opportunity earlier this evening to say a few words or speak with our guest speaker, Hergen, and for the couple of minutes we spoke, or 5 minutes we spoke. It was interesting for me to get the answers of the question I was asking, and it was obvious that what happens in Canada and the province of Quebec and Montreal with different municipalities, we face the same challenges in urbanism in regards to design and approval of plans, development of land. And I had the opportunity today to, I was curious when I read that Mr. Hergen, or Mr. Happ, represents one of the most prominent design firm in the world. And looking at your site says that you have a young team of people, cosmopolitan, speaking 40 languages, and you represent very well the young group of your organization. And it's great to hear young designers and young executives of the industry for the future of our country and the future of the world. So je laisse la parole. Monsieur le professeur, et c'est un honneur encore une fois. Merci pour être ici ce soir. Thank you very much for inviting us to work with you. Thank you.
Before I introduce our guest speaker, I would like to extend a word of thanks to Dea Van Lierop, who was the coordinator of this event and worked hard to make it happen. So thank you very much. Mr. Jürgen Happ is a works at Foster and Partners, which is indeed one of the premier design firms, architectural firms in the world. He comes more from the realm of urban planning and urban design. He's a graduate of first did his professional studies in Germany, but then went on to do his master's degree at the Bartlett School in London, and that's where he lives now. But he worked and lived for a few years in the United Arab Emirates, and he was really at the center of the team from Foster and Partners, who worked on a very, very innovative landmark plan, which he's going to tell us about. And we're very excited to hear about it. He has made this a bit of a signature project. I assume this is the most important project that he worked on. He was the leader of the master design team. And then he stayed on to work on some developments, including some architectural developments in residential areas. So there's probably no one in the world who can say more and knows the project better from the planning and urban design perspective than he. And so I'm very, very grateful that he agreed to fly over all the way from London to come here and talk to us about it. Thank you very, very much for coming. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me, actually. It's always a pleasure to talk about the project, and yes, definitely, it is my signature project I've been working on. And yes, I'm fairly young. I'm above the average at Foster. At Foster, the average age is, I think, 32, which doesn't mean that it's not experienced. It's actually fairly very experienced. We did a lot of landmark projects, like just lately, the Beijing airport, the biggest airport terminal in the world, or one of the biggest buildings in the world, and many other signature buildings, which you for sure have seen some of them. But today, we talk about Master City, which is one of these important projects. And I called it today, actually, a case study on Master City Master Plan, because the project is now going on for about 5 years. And that was actually also the time when I started at Foster & Partners. So I pretty much worked all the time just on that project. Just lately, I changed to a new project. And 5 years working on that project really gives you an opportunity to reflect on certain things and gives you the opportunity to already start post-occupancy studies. Because one part of sustainable master plans and sustainable buildings is always to also question whether the assumptions and the planning you've done in the first place actually came true, whether the wind really goes the direction the arrows of the architects ask the wind to do, or the ventilation in a building. So it's very important to really look back at buildings and see how do they perform. And I think it's done too little, and it should be actually done more often so we know better what to do different in the future. So, and I want to talk a bit about this today, so give you an impression of our concept, give you an impression of how it evolved, how it went into architecture, and then how it means once it's implemented, what are the lessons learned out of it. Master City, it's in Abu Dhabi, and it's planned as a or the government asked basically to start a project which is diversifying the economy. Abu Dhabi is one of these very oil-rich countries. Canada is one of them, but compared to Canada, Abu Dhabi has much less or a much smaller population than Canada. So in proportion to the inhabitants, it's a very rich country. But the sheikhs have also realized actually that in about 50 years or so, or maybe 90 years, but eventually, the oil will run out. So there is the question to diversify the economy. And Master is a project like this, and Master City is one project out of the Master Initiative, which looks into clean technologies, into carbon trade, carbon sequestration. So it's a big initiative, actually, of the government, and the city is one part of it. Just to put it a bit in perspective, so it is a vehicle to diversify the economy into a new, a cleaner world. Because what's also happened is the UAE have realized that actually the global footprint of, or the footprint of its inhabitants is one of the highest in the world. I think just Kuwait or Qatar is higher. So each inhabitant of Abu Dhabi actually uses much more resources than anyone else in the world. And this is the master plan, and I will now show you how it evolved and how this project actually came about. But just a bit to Foster and Partners, as I said, we have a very long tradition actually in working in sustainability. It's not just something which is on our agenda just lately. It actually started already with this one of the signature buildings at the beginning, the Willis Faber building, which is actually, by the way, now a heritage building already. It's grade 2 listed. But it is one of these buildings which already tried to be ahead of its time and try to push the boundaries, as did then the Sainsbury Center or the Reichstag in Berlin, which greatly started to reduce the carbon emissions. And in the last 40 years, more and more experience accumulated, and basically in Master, it's now brought to a different scale, to a city scale. As I mentioned, Master is directly located in Abu Dhabi, which is in the United Arab Emirates, right 150 kilometers away from Dubai. It's a very harsh climate, and you can see here that's one of the main streets in Abu Dhabi. That's how downtown Abu Dhabi looks like. After these blocks, just one block up, you actually see just villa developments and urban sprawl. But that is the main street, about 60 meters wide, and the car dominates the whole public realm here and these fairly high buildings. As you can see here, what is not taken by buildings is taken by the car. There's hardly any public realm. And the buildings in itself are actually designed to a Western somewhat style. They are not performing very well. Although we have a very strong heat, very often you have just single glazing here. And the idea of sustainability, at least 10 years ago, was, well, you just put a reflective glass facade and then it's already done. But these reflective glass facades actually have also quite an impact on the public realm again. And today I really want to talk about public realm and how can we make a public realm better, even in such a harsh climate. And here you see actually the same building here where you see the sun actually shining nicely onto the facade. The architects chose a very high reflective material so that they don't get so much heat gain in the building. But it has to the effect that actually the reflection of the building, which is that shadow here, competes with the shadow of the sun, which is the shadow of the car. And you see how intense actually the sun is. And when you are in this public realm, you suddenly see there's much more energy than just the one from the sun. And actually the public realm and the realm for the people and pedestrian is actually somewhat neglected. So, and if you would be a handicapped person, you would have really a hard time to actually go from A to B without a taxi. So all that and basically also the climate, Abu Dhabi is in a very harsh climate. It's one of the harshest, goes up to 50 degrees Celsius in summertime and about 100% humidity. So it can't get much worse, actually. There's an interesting statistic, actually, from the world, from the WWF together with the footprint network, where they try to illustrate the consumption of the inhabitants of a country. And they have a very interesting equation. They say they calculated all the resources we have on the world, and they said each person right now can use 1.8 hectare of land. And when you then put that in equation, so Brazil and China are very close to actually using just their fair share of resources. The African nations actually are there with half a planet, and then South Africa, because it has evolved a bit further, is already at 1.5 planets. Then in Europe, we are already at 3 planets, so we are already over using basically the natural resources. And here in America, I'm not sure where Canada lies, but I guess it's not far away. It's actually 5 planets. Abu Dhabi is actually on top of that. So that is the fair share of how much land we are using. And looking at now UK, about 70% actually of the total consumption go back to personal use. It goes to transport and to the buildings. And here that's the fraction of the industry. Just if we look at what architects and urban designers can most influence, it's the transport side and the building side, it's 70%. So we have actually a great responsibility to start thinking about how cities should be designed and actually how can we reduce the overall energy consumption, because it can't be that we right now are just living off actually the African and evolving nations. Otherwise, the whole system would already start to collapse. And one thing is really the relationship of density and city's density, and here a lot of urban designers and urban planners, so this graph should be nothing new, where you see Houston at the one extreme with 5 people per hectare and an exorbitant gasoline consumption, and then Hong Kong actually at the other extreme with 285 people per hectare with a very low gasoline consumption, because the density just allows public transport to really fully work. Actually, personal transport is impossible to use in Hong Kong. For master, we said we should actually stick somewhere in the middle, because Hong Kong is extreme, but Houston is definitely not what you call sustainable. And actually, I heard once a statistic that currently all the people in the world could be housed in Texas if they would live in the density of Manhattan. So I took the same now and said, okay, all these people, if they would live in one big city that is as dense as Hong Kong in the year 2050, because we are going up to 9 billion people, actually, space is still enough here. Like, you just would need Norway. I'm not suggesting that that should be the future, but it does show that cities actually are not consuming much land. And you could chop off Norway and distribute it again, and then you would be close to natural resources again. But guess what? If you take Houston, did I unplug myself? No. It's Russia. So, and that is an extreme land consumption. The biggest planet in the biggest country in the world would be just one big city if we would just build everything like Houston. But we were once already clever, and we didn't have cars, which made things easier in terms of having natural constraints, so people didn't want to walk very long. So cities had natural boundaries to them. They needed to be protected because there were a lot of enemies around. But that actually led to a model like Hirshibam in Yemen, which is already a sustainable model. You say it is a compact development. You can walk within it. And because there was the constraint of not having a car and you need to walk, it had a certain size. Around Shibam, there was then arable land, which was actually directly supporting the city. So actually, it could be quite a good model for the future. So we thought, okay, why don't we look back into history before we try to solve everything with new technology? Because everyone thinks, okay, there will be some great magic technology solving the problem. And we thought, maybe not. Maybe it is consider first what you use, and then later the great technology is going to come. So we looked into, for example, what density means in these Arabic cities. Shibam was one. We looked at Fez in Morocco and Aleppo in Syria. So a great deal of cities actually are looking at the open spaces of public and private, and the street space. Like, how could these cities exist in this harsh climate without actually having air conditioning? And of course it is the tightness of the street, the small openings of the windows, the very tall buildings here in Shibam, and the close distance really. Now, looking at Abu Dhabi, and Master is just at the corner, actually, to the airport here, we're actually very well connected to public transport, if you see flying as such a form, but not maybe too well here in the framework of Abu Dhabi. But Abu Dhabi has realized, actually, that it needs to do something. It cannot just rely on cars. So they put, actually, a quite comprehensive plan on public transport and introducing public transport into the city. And then actually Masda doesn't look so bad anymore in terms of its location, because we are actually at the high-speed link to Dubai, just very short to the Abu Dhabi airport, and then you have the metro line and the LRT connecting to the neighboring development. So actually it's a strategic good position now. Just to put it in perspective, the site of Masda is about 6 square kilometers large, and that is Venice in the same scale, so we could actually build something like Venice. And once you see how long it took to evolve Venice and how complex and interesting the streets are, it's actually, you should realize already, it's actually not a job you're just making once, a master plan and that's it, and you just execute it. It must be something that evolves, and that here is already the second master plan we have evolved in the 5 years, so we had made a complete makeover, and there will be more to come. But the basic and the key principles are really, if we were to continue the urban sprawl which comes from the site with 12 people per hectare roughly, we would run out quickly out of space, and we would need to acquire the airport to build a bit more. That's why I said actually, and having looked before at the densities which are sustainable, we put it to 145, so that the size of the city reduces already. Then you look at the basic parameters of wind and sun, which gives you the basic street grid. Then looking at city ventilation gives you the main green corridors in the city. Then the corridors for the metro and the tram or LRT gives you already the key elements which start slicing off the city. We are actually, in fact, occupying a bit less than 50% of our site actually with the city, and that's one of the key considerations already. Just because you have a land, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to use the land. So you can leave the land free for the time being and develop a site which is sustainable with it in itself, and then future generations can decide what to do with that land. But first we need to deal with the city inside and really work hard to make that work. And I tell you, after 5 years of working, it is sometimes quite tempting for people to actually jump over the boundary and say, oh, let's build it here, although inside is not still so much space. And actually constraint sometimes helps to create better design, because you need to think harder than if you have just all the freedom in the world. So constraints is important. Within the city, we have about 50,000 people commuting in. Because it is a clean tech cluster, there will be a lot of jobs there, and just 40,000 people living there. We did then some analysis so that the density will vary through the city. So that's a diagram of the density in Masda. And we compared it with, for example, Notting Hill, which is actually one of the high-end neighborhoods in London, which achieves very high real estate value and rent. So it's actually something people actually do desire. It's not always just the urban sprawl model, which has economic benefit. Or here, New York East Village. So we are somewhat in between here. So we always started to benchmark the project to really understand where we are lying in terms of other cities and how they work. But now the real question is, how do you come from something like a car-driven city, here you see an image of LA, actually, to something that looks, again, more pedestrian-friendly? And of course, it's very trivial. Most of the stuff I'm telling, actually, I think always it's quite common sense. You start designing around the person again. And like in Shibam, how far can a person walk to go to the necessary amenities? How far then can he use cycling or bikes? And then how does that work with the transport interchange? So you come to the bus stop, to the tram stop, and the metro stop, and from the metro you come into downtown Abu Dhabi or to the airport. But the basic message is we need to design around the person, not necessarily around the car. But I mentioned Abu Dhabi is a very harsh climate, so we cannot ignore it. So we need to understand what does it actually climate and how is our sensation of heat, and more importantly, how can we actually manipulate the sensation of heat. So there are things like the direct sun, the air temperature, relative humidity and reflection from surfaces of the buildings and of the floors. But when you then look closer, actually, there are basically two parameters in the heat to really look after. It's the sun and the wind. And when you see already, a bit of wind actually brings you already benefits here. 1 meter per second already, you have a great benefit. But actually, you have a greater benefit when you put first shading in. So this graph shows you the neutral line between the sensation of heat and cold in relation between wind speed and air temperature and also some clothing, just basically t-shirt or so clothing. And the average person basically has no heat or cold sensation on this line. And that's actually quite amazing. It's quite low. No wind speed and direct sun means you have this neutral line at about 15 degrees. If you introduce shade, you have that sensation just at 25 degrees. And then if you introduce some wind, you have it at 32 degrees. We are much higher. We are still talking at 50 degrees, but still we need to look at these parameters first before we start really designing the city. But that is a very abstract graph, and we hate looking at abstract things. Therefore, it's actually much nicer to look at one of these thermal images where some suffering colleagues of mine were actually really standing out there and testing it. What does it mean actually to come right from an AC space? So here the spectrum is 20 degrees to 50 degrees. Here he just came out of the air-conditioned space. He stood already more than 5 minutes in the sun, and he stood 5 minutes in the shade. But clearly you see, like, someone who stands for 5 minutes in the sun has more than 50 degrees on the temperature on the surface, and that can't be really healthy. So we said, okay, the first thing is really shade, and we've learned that already from Shibam and all the old examples. So the people in older days, they knew already building the buildings close gives you natural shading, and that's already good. And then, of course, we said wind. We need wind. Therefore, we did a lot of wind tunnel tests, and some were done here in Toronto at RWDI, and they did a great length verify all the assumptions. So we did a lot of wind tunnel tests. And one thing which you also see in Abu Dhabi, there is we have these wind towers traditionally done to enhance the thermal comfort within the buildings. And now we did it here for the public realm. And here you see roughly the functioning. It catches wind up there, and it leads wind down into the public realm and enhances the thermal comfort there. All these measurements actually bring you that. So if you were in the desert in the heat of the summer, you would actually experience something like 66 degrees. That's the perceived temperature with an air temperature of 46 degrees. If you are in downtown Abu Dhabi, it's 71 degrees. So it's extreme heat stress, actually, which can be dangerous. In shaded colonnades, you are at 51 degree, and here in lush gardens, 47, the green helps you, and then water helps you even more, so 46 degrees. It's still hot. We are not discussing whether it's not hot. But there is something, it's not as extreme anymore. And you will actually be surprised. Like, I was walking around there for quite a while, and we always had the benchmark of walking for 5 minutes or 3 minutes. Actually, you can do it in 20 minutes, but then it gets quite hot. Okay, getting the city structure is as well very important. Getting it right, and so understanding how it works in old cities. Here, that is the space syntax analysis in old Shiraz. We just did that to basically make a sensible street layout where people can actually walk or where our land use is distributed as sensible as possible. So we did these space syntax analyses, and it's very abstract. Basically, the redder it gets, the more connected a street is. The less red, the more yellow or green it is, the less connected it is, and therefore less people are going to walk by. That is very abstract, but we show an example how that works actually here. We have the Millennium Bridge in London, which was built for the new millennia. But what was interesting, actually, we did the same analysis here and looking at this area. And what you can see at the Tate Modern, here's the River Thames, there is something not very connected. It's all very green, and these lines are not very strong either. After introducing the Millennium Bridge, you see this fabric here starts to connect much stronger. You get more yellow, and also that here starts to read a bit stronger. So these links do have a meaning. And beside being great architecture or great engineering, it does also fulfill something for the city, where you see like a 40% increase in visitors to St. Paul's because we have more connectivity. So these analyses really look into how can we get people more connected and the public realm more connected. But that is also measurable in macroeconomics, like here 100 million pound more on economic benefit in a year. So sometimes infrastructure has also a purpose for the whole macroeconomics. Another example here in World Squares in London, here the Houses of Parliament, here's Trafalgar Square. We did analyze all these sites, and out of this there was the question, can we help Trafalgar Square? This is actually an image after the Trafalgar Square was redone. Most people and I just knew it like that, but it actually was different. There was a wall here in the back and no connection between the portrait gallery and the square. Actually, the square was a gigantic roundabout, and all the streets were going around and basically landlocking it. And that was when we first worked with these tools about spatial analysis and walking. So the blue ones are where people actually walked, and the red one is where people stood. So the square was a standing space, and the walking space was all around, but there was not much interaction between these two. Here you see all the bus, basically, and the traffic here, and that's afterwards. And what the model has really shown is really, if you would tear down this wall, bring in a staircase here, and linking to portrait gallery and making that a shared space, then you will have much more connectivity. And now we know Trafalgar Square has become really the center of London, which it maybe didn't have before in that form. So from that, we actually started evolving these tools much further. And actually here you see like some it's a different graphic, but it shows what are the more connected places. And actually we're always frustrated about, here you see the agents walking actually, but that always takes too long to make a design and then change it and then get it analyzed, and then this feedback loop just took too long. So in-house we developed now this tool where you can actually work on a touch screen. You can straight away carve things into the plots and see how the connectivity changes. And the software is actually also quite clever. It can also do CFD modeling, very, very basic CFD modeling, but and visual connections here. But what is really important is, I've just used that on the new project I'm working on, directly with the client, so you can really in a workshop start discussing the effects of something and you're not needing to go back and sketching it and doing it again. So we're evolving these methods further. So all these spatial analyses basically led to this diagram, which then led to our street hierarchy in the city. And then you see here the walking distance. It takes about 10 minutes to go into the center of the city, about 3 to 5 minutes here to the main LRT stops, and then the bus circulation again. So we are very well covered. The land use also follows the street hierarchy of the most connected streets, really. So you want to have the land use there where the people are and not the land use or the people going there where the land use is. So it should be natural, and that's why we did all these analyses, actually. And here you see the main retail fronts as well on the main streets. At the beginning, we thought, actually, we should make a city which is layered where the infrastructure is actually at the ground, and then we have this transport system which goes underneath the city, and the pedestrian realm is actually above, cantilevered, basically elevated above. Now, in the new master plan, we are actually looking in a shared space concept where really the utilities are within the public realm, and we really try to reduce the space for utilities. And it's one of the biggest battle actually with utility providers to actually give you the space back. Once they had the right to build somewhere with their pipe, they will not give it up again. So we have spent quite a great deal of time actually to try to have the space back, because they always want a future proof for the future, for some future technology. But I'm always wondering, how can this future technology ever come into cities like London, which is built like that? And how can a future technology actually work if it can't work in cities like London? So why do we always future proof for everything? Also, the question of the car, actually, yes, you can make better fuel-efficient cars, but still a car causes a traffic jam, and it needs a lot of space, actually. Here you see the statistic of seeing the same amount of cars with the same amount of people. It's an awful wasteful device. But actually what we thought, is there a more clever way with working with individual transport, and that are these PRT pods, which where you basically just put in your destination and it drives you to your location. Actually, we calculated you need just about 2,000 of these cars for about 35,000 individual cars. So actually looking into new forms of transport, and these are pilot projects. They are driving out in master. There are 10 of them, and you can just go there, you push the button, and it drives you to the next station. But it's a pilot project, it won't continue in that form, so we have a very resilient master plan still. But it's very interesting to also think ahead of how could transport evolve. So the cars mainly remain at the edge of the city. We have the metro and the LRT, the bus network, and of course a cycle and pedestrian network which then connects the city to the surrounding, and hopefully there will be eventually a cycle network in Abu Dhabi, and then we can link into that. So that was the vision, and that was about 3 years ago. No, actually 4 years now, 3.5 years. And that image was about one and a half years ago. And that's what I meant. It is an extremely fast project, and it gives us the opportunity now to start testing some of our theories. And starting off with the thermal comfort. So in-house we have these environmental scientists who can do that. So they have this equipment which really starts to measure the same parameters as a human really starts to receive. And I'm not going in great detail, I just want to show you actually as much as they're possible. So you see here Abu Dhabi, the central street in Abu Dhabi. You have buildings 38 degrees. You see the insulation of the building is not working very well. And you have asphalt with 57 degrees. So it's extreme heat stress here again. And then looking at the master streets, which has here it's the same 55 degrees, but the PV panels on top. So we keep the heat up on the roofs as it was in the old cities, and then the walls actually 35 degrees, but they are not 35 degrees because they are air conditioned from the inside, opposing to the Abu Dhabi example. They are actually cool because they are naturally shaded, and they are they have a low thermal mass, so they are not keeping the heat or the energy. And the ground is actually 33 degrees, and that is actually an amazing result, because we never thought that that would be possible, that you have a lower temperature as the body here and as the air temperature. So it means actually the person standing here receives cool energy from the ground. So it's actually really cooling the street. We have a difference in ground temperature of 24 degrees at the same day, but a difference of 15 degrees in radiant temperature. So that is the perceived temperature, and that's actually really a great success of it. But now you see really the one of the public realms, people really walk in extreme heat of 57 degrees, so that the scale actually starts just going into white. It's so hot. The same image here in the central square of Master, you have 40 degrees and 33 degrees. And here you see the wind tower. So we said, okay, let's test the wind tower. Does it also work with wind and with the evaporative cooling device, which basically ejects water into the wind tower? So first we looked at the thermal image and tried to see how that works. The water basically spraying into this wind tower and giving the wind a downdraft, so really pushing the wind down. And yeah, but you can't really see the wind going down. You just see the water actually evaporating here. So, and that's where the balloons come into play. You take a balloon. The balloon normally falls to the ground. You fill it with a bit of helium. It goes up again, and it reaches this level. So it won't go up or down, even unless there is wind or some kind of air movement. And that's what we want to see now, because we really want to see the arrows architects always draw in drawings. So now we had a lot of fun pumping up these balls, and they are really falling down. So that's the first time that I actually could really visibly see the arrows of which you always draw in a drawing. And here you actually see, if you put it more in a time-lapse or in a still montage, you really see how the balls start to rotate around it. And there are different speeds, so that's something you measure then, but it's actually quite interesting to see really how the air flows. And of course, all the balloons were then in the public space and they distributed nicely. But down there, the airflow is not actually as strong anymore. It's the strongest at the wind tower. But it's also interesting, while we had this thermal camera already in Abu Dhabi, it's actually quite an expensive device. Also looking at other things, the cars and the heat injection of the car, and you see actually there's a traffic light, there are no cars, but you still see the heat of the cars actually in front of the traffic light. I'm always amazed by these images. And then look at an electric car on the side, it's completely, you just see a bit of heat from the heat rejection of the air conditioning, but nothing close to what a car actually wastes on energy. Here, that's pure energy that is just wasted because the efficiency of a car is maybe at 33-35%. The rest is going just into heat. So we've talked a lot about the city now, and I want to talk a bit about architecture and how the architecture actually does make the city. Here you see just the surrounding is mainly the park. We have energy production here around the city, but also some of the utilities are basically located outside the perimeters. But we always said it should be really, it's not a utilities dumping ground. It is really a place that should be for the people, where people can walk around, where you have recreational purposes, where you have sports fields and the like. But also research and development, because Master is a research park. We should give space for R&D where PV panels and so on can be tested straight there. But one of the big seeds is actually the Master Institute, and the images you've seen just are out of this Master Institute, out of the first phase. And like in the Silicon Valley, you really have this institute as the founding seed of the innovation. So that is the first phase. We are currently, that's finished, and we are currently building that part. And when we were designing that building, it was all about, okay, how does the principles of the city actually go now into architecture and into a campus for the students? And we said, okay, it's actually the same principles on a smaller scale, walkability and distance. So the labs are basically in the middle, because that's the heart of this whole development. The student housing is basically wrapped around in very close proximity. But the ground floor, for example, has just public amenities and social spaces. And then you have this iconic building, the knowledge center, the library, that's for the knowledge exchange. And you have energy production on the roof. And whenever we start designing sustainable buildings, we always look at this pyramid. It's meaning what has the greatest environmental gain with the lowest cost? Because we first need to look at the easy wins. And we don't want to just start with the gadgets up here and try to rescue the whole project. So we really need to look first for the right orientation and the form, and then for the passive measurements, which might cost a bit more, but still not as much as the active one. So really looking into this pyramid and structure the project that way. And doing that, so we achieved quite great reductions. For example, portable water consumption for the institute is 54% lower than business as usual in Abu Dhabi. Cooling demand is 55% lower, and electrical demand 50%. Electrical demand is very interesting, actually, especially when you look into renewable energies and renewable energy production. And here you see one of these typical energy curves, because the energy providers actually not providing always the same amount of energy. They really need to always match the energy that comes. But first we said we should really push the whole energy demand down through energy efficiency. So that means through passive designs and the orientation, as I mentioned before, and self-shading. So the residential facade has a very expressive self-shading facade where we use balconies to really bring as much shade to the classed areas in the back. The institute and the lab buildings are much more industrial. They have these louvers and fins to really cut out the direct sunlight. And the library, because it's a public library building which needs a lot of reading light, actually has a different shape. All are based on the same design guideline. And that's the interesting thing. We've set the design guidelines which shouldn't restrict the architects in the creativity, but which should actually help evolving or generating buildings that are meaningful and fit together and have actually a purpose. But it's depending on the function, the solutions are different. Of course, with the residential units, we looked into how did old cities do it with the proximities and privacy, because you need to give privacy to people. And beautiful elements like these thick bay windows where people can really sit in and look what happens on the streets. It's really a quite nice attitude, actually, of the buildings to the public realm and the people here who sit in these bay windows and can really look what's happening. And that's especially important when you work in the Islamic world, where privacy is a much bigger topic than in our world. And that really started to generate actually these facades where you have the balconies and these little niches where after behind there are little seats where you can really look down the street. And the angle of this curve really gives you a long distance view along the street corridor. But it's also about heritage when you go into the building design. And here we basically engaged with a French artist, Jean-Marc Castera, who is a mathematician actually, but he dedicated his life to the Arabian patterns, which are really an interesting topic by itself. So we engaged with him. He wrote this book, and he actually created these patterns for the buildings here. So wherever we needed some screening, but we wanted to have lights behind, there would be these pattern screens. In the section, these buildings are also natural ventilated, and what's actually quite interesting, in the night, the buildings actually work in such a way that they flush also the heat out of the street. So here you see the lab building, that's the street, and that's the residential building. It really starts flushing out the energy. And here you see a lab building. It's a more technical building. And because we need to have flexibility within the building, we have more these horizontal windows, so we can really adjust the rooms inside. So you see that here. The concept with the labs is really that we didn't make a floor plan how all these lab benches should actually be, because we said actually we don't know, and we can't know how it's going to be in the future, and there we need to plan as much flexibility in as possible, because at the end of the day, when you have a building that can last double the amount of time, you reduce basically the energy it used to get produced by 50% basically. But also, it's from a project actually in Stanford University, we learned that these concepts are very nice, but they are not true if you don't bring it to the last detail. And here you see actually these lab benches. Everything about this lab bench is done in the way that it animates the students to really start regrouping these benches. So there are little wheels here, and all these connections are easy to use. As soon as you need someone else from maintenance or facilities to move these things around, it won't happen. So you need to make it as friendly as possible for the people so that the students themselves really move it around. And trust me, that image was just done after these benches came in. Now when you go there, it looks all over the place. And that's exactly how it should look like. The students really group these benches around. If they work on something engineering, they really group it around and they can work together. And that's important for buildings. And that building can last for quite a while now because it's so resilient and flexible. Different, the knowledge center, because here it's about reading, it's about knowledge exchange and books. It's a new word for basically library. So here we designed this shell-like structure, which is really like a cap around your face, trying to cut out all the sunlight of the facade. But also it does more. It actually starts generating energy. But photovoltaic panels are expensive, so you should just put it there where you have the biggest yield of energy. Therefore, we did all these modelings to really define where should these photovoltaic modules be. As I mentioned, like one of the rules in Master 100% shading of the classed areas at, I think, 8 months of the year. This means this is a sequence just checking that we're actually conforming with that. So see, in winter, there's some light on this facade, but all the other time, there's actually no direct sunlight. And it's a very easy rule, and it creates great architecture that has meaning. So you see now this cap actually and the glass facade, which actually also quite interesting. We had the choice either you make a very long cantilever, which is structurally very hard to make, or you basically cut back the facade to really give you the shade. So again, it's a very economic solution to the rule. That's before the books came basically, and here in the back, to get some ventilation through the roof structure and some indirect light into that space. So we always try to create different spaces in that campus so people can come together. Looking at the energy consumption now, all these passive measurements had actually one thing, one result. So wait, let's go back. If you look at the normal consumption in Abu Dhabi, you have about 2/3 energy goes a bit more for cooling, and 1/3 for plug-in loads is laptops, things you bring and plug in, basically. Now, with all the passive measurements, which are mainly looking at cooling loads, you basically start reversing the proportion between plug-in loads and cooling loads. So suddenly, it makes sense to look at how much does the computer actually need, or how much does a light bulb need. But more importantly, it's actually now, because we have pushed the basic base load down, the peak gets actually proportionally even bigger. And peak energy is always expensive energy, because you need to provide it just at short periods of time. And the utility providers, that's their biggest cost, but also that's where they really make money. But you can be clever about the peak, and you can try to shift the peak into the valleys, actually. And everyone talks always about smart grid and smart intelligent devices, but I never knew why. But with that diagram, basically, you can see why. And so Master has actually done a pilot project together with General Electric, where it looks at a smart metering and smart devices, so really to start pushing the energy use into the valleys. So for example, the washing machine, you put your washing load in, and you say in the next 5 hours you want to have it washed, and the washing machine actually gets a signal when the tariff is cheapest, and then basically the washing machine starts by itself. But that looks a very easy diagram, but it needs the public, the government of the country to really set new standards, because in no country that is yet the case, that you really have these flexible tariffs which are actually by the hour or by the minute. And the interesting thing of the Institute is really that you can start studying these things. So the whole lab buildings, it's not just about the research happening within the labs, it's also about the research happening within the buildings and the public realm. So we said actually at the end, the whole Master Institute is actually a big live lab. And it's a live lab for us, for the master planning, but also for the students and of the Institute. And then you have some actually quite vicious solutions to the peak. It's peak shaving. And the Institute actually looks at something, whether you can actually manipulate the temperature in a building and whether people would accept that, where you say, okay, during peak time, during half an hour, you actually tell the building you can go up by 2 degrees, and you will. The Institute now will actually test whether people are actually going to realize these half an hour, whether it really goes up to 2 degrees. Because if they don't realize it and if they don't mind it, it would save a great deal of energy. At the end of the day, this whole project should be powered by 100% renewable energies, of different sorts, really, photovoltaic, you have evacuated thermal tubes, waste to energy, or concentrated solar power. The mix changes with the economies, and again, in the master plan, the principles should be set, but the solutions come through the process. But here we are in a good position that there is already a 10 megawatt PV farm, which basically supplies surplus energy for the Institute. So currently the whole Institute is actually carbon negative. So it produces more energy than it actually uses itself. But it's not just PVs. It looks into geothermal for district cooling or different forms of solar power, like these parabolic drafts or this solar downbeam tower. So here you see a whole array of pilot projects which have already started and can be seen in the city. So the basic principles, like with the buildings, it's this hierarchy. So we first need to look in the energy to conserve. That's the easy wins, and it's just, it doesn't necessarily need more money to make that. It might need a bit more time to actually plan it properly, but not so much more money. Then you manage it. That is the smart media, smart grids and smart appliances, and then you generate it. Am I already over? Just 5 minutes, I think, or 10. But also looking at the material cycle, it's actually also important. Sustainable developments, you need to look into how does it work from a materials flow, a person's consumption, into can we recycle it, can we bring it into the non-recyclables, into an energy cycle. So after all, we need to look into the whole material cycle. I didn't want to go too much into detail today because that would be a whole another story. But what's actually interesting when we look at material and just look at construction material, it's quite interesting because 20% of the materials have about 80% of embodied carbon. And that's actually quite frightening but also quite encouraging, because you don't need to deal with 100% of all materials. You can actually just concentrate in the first run at the 20%. And actually, these are just four or five materials. And when you look in more detail, actually you see there's concrete with 40% and steel with 20%. That together actually makes that more than about 50% is actually in the reinforced concrete. And there we have already solutions, GGPS or fly ash. So introducing means like that, which comes from the steel industry, and by the way, it's more cheaper. It is cheaper than normal cement from the cement industry, but the cement industry actually sells it more expensive. But GGPS and fly ash can actually greatly reduce the embodied carbon in concrete. So there are ways already also looking at the embodied energy. But we need to look at the life cycle of it. So there is always excess material. There's always something that will be broken away, but then you can start using it. And that is already the on-site waste sorting facility in Masterbridge, where the concrete gets crushed directly on-site, or the wood gets basically also chipped and then used for other purposes. Here the concrete gets used as a substructure for the roads, and actually quite interesting, the wood gets used in the landscaping we have. We have little landscaping because we can't have too much landscaping because it uses too much water, but actually using now these recycled wood here in these planters helps reducing the water consumption for irrigation even further. So it's just one of the examples where you need to look across borders of different things to really get the full sustainable stories. We cannot just look in little isolated boxes. We need to really look at the whole process and framework. And then this is basically the institute from the outside, and that is one of the main city squares. And very often in architecture images, that's where you are happy when it looks a bit like that. And but there's something missing here. And because our great thing at the beginning was we want to get more better places for people. We really want to create spaces for people, but here are no people. It's because it wasn't open yet. Because actually Master then made this market, and which was actually quite nice to have this little city market or urban market already. And they actually expected something like, I think, 3,000 people to come. And people came and flocked in. And at the end, it was, I think, five times more than they expected at this one afternoon. And that was actually in spring, summertime. So it wasn't actually that cold either. So people came, and it really showed us that it's actually something that even people and residents of Abu Dhabi are actually craving for, and they want to have these spaces. And actually, when you sometimes look there, and I that was one of the most or the best experiences I had. Normally, when as an architect, when you go on site, you are done when the project is done and you leave again. Fortunately, we were still employed and working on the next phase and on the master plan, so we stood there for another year, so I could see the full cycle of a year of how people starting to use it. And it actually was quite amazing that in this space, mothers or young mothers or mothers with their young children would actually come to master. They have nothing to do with the institute. They would just come there. Here on the right side is a cafe. They would sit there, and the children would play here in the water features and so on. So it's actually also a place where people who nothing have to do with the institute come because they have a relaxing time, and the kid there can be absolutely safe. It will not be run over by a car, which unfortunately happens too often in Abu Dhabi. So it's a great place, and you see here, people come for functions as well. So and that is really the success story about it, that people came and come and use it and continues to come. And that is what this master plan at the end is all about. We need to create spaces that are, again, well designed for people and that people enjoy to use and not just find it burdenful to cross because there are roads. And on that note, I'm finished. Exactly, Noah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It certainly is worth taking the time to show us a complex project under all its dimensions. There is some time left for questions and comments, and there is actually a microphone in the center of the room. If you don't use it, I would like you to speak up so everyone can hear you. It is being recorded. Yes. Ladies first. Ladies first.
The justification of that is to get more coverage inside and still have a proper speed. So we could have made just a diagonal, but basically an LRT needs to stop and start anyway. And there's a certain distance between stops to make it feasible. So we said, okay, let's lengthen the line, and so you have a greater coverage within the city area. That was the reason. To get more access to the LRT. On a diagonal, we would have hardly gotten three stops, and so we could have four stops. And it's actually a local thing. It's the metro is the one which goes to the downtown. The LRT is really like a tram in any city. And I could show you some diagrams from Zurich. We compared the LRT alignment with Zurich. There is much more. There are much more lines in these organically grown cities. So LRTs can actually nicely adjust to curves.
Can you also, I was curious if you could tell us a little bit more about the personal rapid transit system?
Yeah. It's actually an amazing system, which if you think about that, when we started the project, it was just one real project I can think of that magnitude, and that was for London Heathrow. And they were already in the planning process, and we started actually afterwards. And it was actually implemented earlier. But the interesting thing about that is we were tasked to look at all areas of cities and how can you innovate and make certain things better. And one question was basically transport. And there's a lot of inefficiency in the transport system and the way everyone drives the car. Because everyone has actually a tendency to drive faster or slower. And basically within the whole system of roads, there's a lot of inefficiencies which comes through the way we use the car. So we said, okay, there is a need for individual transport. Of course, most people should actually use public transport, as do most people in dense cities, or like look at London, it's more than 50% using public transport. But then for those who use individual transport, there should be a certain automation in it, or at least the opportunity to automate it. And that pilot project actually looks into how the logistics of that. And actually, quite interestingly, now in the current economy, I think Economist, it's a new article, or Financial Times, I'm not sure. There was an article that more and more companies are looking into automation in cars. And right now, it's just in the high-end car section that you have certain automations. But the pressure in the car industry will go further to the idea of automated driving. And we will see it more on highways than in the cities, but it makes the traffic more smooth. And that was the reason behind the PRT, beside being an electric mean of transport, also to look into the system of how you can make driving more efficient. But it's a pilot project for the whole city. It won't be rolled out.
What
do you mean?
As far as, well, the actual construction. When you construct something as large in scale as Masdar, you create a huge amount of waste product. And I want to find out how that waste product was dealt with.
I just showed it to you, the material recycling center, and it's unprecedented, actually, in the UAE. And actually, the material recycling center, actually, some other projects, even in the Western world, wouldn't go to that extent. And there are hardly developers who would do that. And the other question is, of course, always when you construct, you need energy to construct it. And I mentioned it earlier, actually. We still have needs to construct, and we have a growing population in certain parts of the world, so they need to be housed somewhere. And then there's also pressure for the more economies evolve, the more wasteful we are with space. It's an evolution that people in the Western world are just using more and more space. So you can question whether we should build at all or whether we shouldn't build. But if you build, then you should do it sustainable. The Master Institute, for example, has used GGPS, which reduces greatly the use of cement, which is the biggest energy burden on a building. So there have been measurements taken. And there are actually quite good success stories behind Master, where, for example, aluminium was a banned material. And then a local aluminium producer came and said, hey, why did you ban my material? I want to do business with you. And they said, well, it's a not sustainable product, so how can we use it now? And then there was actually a discussion and a process where Master helped this producer to come up with a different solution. Because the good thing about aluminium is it's very energy intense when you make it, but you can recycle it actually later. Yeah, and it's very good to recycle. So he started actually having a new product where he used recycled material which to create the aluminium. And that's something which hasn't been done in Abu Dhabi before or in the UAE. The same with steel. Master was the first project to really use steel of recycled content. It actually started to change the supply chain for UAE because it wasn't on the market as well before. So I'm not sure to which news you're referring to, but there are great success stories behind it. And the construction of it, if there's something to be constructed, then make it sustainable, because it could also have been constructed in a complete non-sustainable way.
Presentation in terms of the master planning process, you showed some examples of the use of modeling, specifically on pedestrian movement. What was the basis for the calibration of the model, and subsequently, what was the basis for the confirmation that your assumptions and the calibration were accurate?
What I've showed for Master was the spatial analysis, which is a purely geometric tool, which measures basically in relation the connectivity. So the theory behind it is, and I'm not sure whether you, well, let's take it from London. Oxford Street in London, for those who were in London, it's the one, the main shopping street actually, in the heart of London, is the most connected place of London. The space syntax people from the UCL, basically it's developed by UCL and it's called space syntax, and that's the method we used, basically measures the amount of turns you need to do to get to a certain point. So those streets who are most connected are those where you need the least amount of turns and change of direction to get to. So from a calibration point of view, it's basically it's in relation to the network. The one which I showed before with the agents that is qualitative, where you see the main routes and the secondary routes, and that's something we are developing currently in house, and we're also looking into how it can be calibrated. But it's meant to be something where you say, from a geometric point of view, which points are most connected and best to reach, and parameters like land use and so on is the next level to put on top to get a more refined thing. I hope that answered the question.
A lot of times in North America, projects that aim to do smaller streets and narrower rights of way face trouble with fire departments and local stores trying to get deliveries done. They're used to kind of a car-based system of doing that. How does this plan kind of accommodate, fire access and deliveries? And did you run into any problems with local authorities and business owners in doing so?
It's a very interesting story, actually. Good question. Talking with authorities in the Western world might be already challenging sometimes. I don't want to say anything. I said it before, authorities have a really important role to play in this whole game, and they sometimes actually just need to put the game properly out and say, okay, these are the rules we want to play in. And actually, there should be much more dialogue between developers and the authorities, because at the end of the day, both are in the same boat and should evolve the city further. But talking in the Middle East and authorities, the whole process is a complete, it's even more difficult, let's say like that. Especially with the fire department. And we talked about this issue for a year and so on, and we had two different consultants and so on. At the end of the day, it went down to a one-to-one test. We said, okay, there are so many cities in the world, and we are not talking about alleyways. We are talking about street width of 10 meter and 6 meter with hardly cars in. So it shouldn't be a big issue. It was an issue. We actually built a one-to-one model of the street corners with scaffolding and everything. And it was a big happening, actually. That's the nice thing in Abu Dhabi, or in the Middle East. There is like cafe and people sitting in a big row and looking. It's really quite interesting. You really think you're in the wrong movie now. But then, basically, the head of the fire department rings up his guys and then says, well, that's the alarm. And then he stands there with his stopwatch and then basically stopped how long it took them from coming from the fire station, driving down our parkour, driving around all possible corner conditions, and then it was approved, basically. This test was so successful that they actually started making a race out of it. Take that off the record, please.
Ecological city. My question relates to more at a building scale, but I suppose this can be applied to the city scale. Mm. Are there efforts at the Institute to conduct whole life cycle cost-benefit analysis of the building cost versus its energy consumption?
Life cycle costing is always a very good topic. I'm still scratching my head about certain issues there. There is definitely, and we did in the process of designing it, certain life cycle costing already. For example, when you look at the triple glazing, or the glazing of the facades, initially it was thought we should have actually triple glazing, but then through some excessive life cycle costing analysis, it basically turned out that it's actually cheaper to produce a bit more energy than to go for the third level of third layer of glass. So life cycle costing is in every sense very important. But there's something quite tricky about it as well, because sometimes in macroeconomics, you have certain subsidies on one side you don't have on the other side. And it's especially when you look at renewable energies and conventional energies, that's where it gets really messy. And that's where it's actually more clarity needed from the authorities, where you say, okay, if you have conventional energy which is subsidized, and a lot of countries that is the case, and then you come then with renewable energies, and then you're battling already against something which is cheaper than it should actually be. So life cycle costing must be on a level playground. It's very often not. In Abu Dhabi, for example, conventional energy is so cheap, Abu Dhabi would be better off selling the oil or gas they use to produce it than to produce the energy, because it's highly subsidized, actually. So life cycle costing in such an environment is rather difficult.
Do you have plans for anyone at the Institute to...
The Institute works on these things. They have different courses. I can't speak for the Institute, so I can't say it with full certainty, but I know they're looking into the whole carbon issue. They are not just technically. They also look at policy work and all these issues. So they are quite broadly, and that's the idea behind it, that subjects of basically sustainable topics, different sustainable topics, come together to that institute to come up with some solutions. Okay, starting first with modal share, at the moment is rather difficult because these public transport means are not in yet. And that's maybe also one of the big lessons learned, not from what we've done, but also the trickiness of some setups of certain master plans, especially when they are so grand and so wide-reaching as they are in some parts of the world. Because certain projects might come faster, might come slower. And as we know, very often with these big infrastructure projects, they come rather late than too early. So we don't have yet the metro or the LRT in place. Therefore, at the beginning, it's very hard to really change the modal split. So basically right now, a lot of people come with the car. But what was quite encouraged, and we did it ourselves, like our team, we teamed up and basically ran the bus, which picked us up in the morning, brought us there and went back. So about 6 to 7 people were basically in one of these little mini buses. And so that was our little contribution to modal, reducing the modal share, which on the construction side, also the program managers did it and all that. It needs fundamentally first the public transport to really come in place. And then, of course, you can have little initiatives like car sharing, but where there is also some trickiness behind where, in, for example, Dubai, to prevent people from being illegal taxi drivers, car sharing is actually a problem. So if the police stops you, having someone in the car, it could actually get quite messy. We haven't heard of a case, but that's where, again, the framework by the public authorities also needs some clearance to do certain things. And that's something where you say, like, car sharing is such a trivial thing when you come, at least from Europe, but there you come and the framework is not there yet. There are many surprises in the project, but that's why it's also one of the big lessons. Try to keep a master plan in certain extents flexible, keep the principles and the framework right, but make it adaptable. And okay, we could have just said, okay, let's make a universal grid and it's going to work one way or the other. But we rather said, okay, let's try to grow it organically, and you keep always the growth zones rather compact, and then you can basically adjust at a later stage. I'm not sure whether I answered your question, but I don't have something burning in my mind now, which was the biggest lesson learned. The big lessons learned is, if you want to do a project like that, actually, you need to get it on the ground that people can start feeling it, rather than debating about it and show all these graphs. At the end of the day, you need to go there and feel it and experience it to judge it. And we were pleasantly surprised that, or not pleasantly, we were positively that people really liked it that much.
Good evening. With private cars and private vehicles mostly relegated to the perimeter car parks, how are deliveries of heavier goods accommodated, such as furniture, merchandise, and similar things for the residents and shopkeepers? And also, you covered how refuse is processed, but how is it collected without the ability to have heavy goods vehicles?
Yeah. There are different technologies in discussion. There is space for a vacuum system, but it's not in place in the first phase because it would be too small. Again, question of life cycle costing and so on. Once you have taken out the individual cars, logistics are actually not the big deal, and all the streets and turning radius are enough to get a truck into it. But there's an interesting story actually about that as well. And there we can look actually at something like London Regent Street. Crown Estate owns the whole Regent Street development, and as their contribution to logistics or to reducing the carbon footprint of London, they said, okay, we consolidate now the logistics, because they found out that actually most trucks in cities are actually just 25% full, so they are 75% empty most of the time. So there's a great incentive actually to consolidate these, and once you have started consolidating the goods and the movement, first you reduce the amount of vehicular movement, and second you are also able to then to go into electric trucks, and that's what Crown Estate in London is doing right now. But of course you need to have a certain level of management and so on to do that. We proposed that for Master, but right now it's too small yet to get started with that, to start consolidating. So, and space is enough there to accommodate it. It's like in any other city, older cities where you can get your deliveries at your door front. In some cities, it's regulated by the authorities in the morning between 7 and 9 or something like that. And that's how European cities deal with it. There's a certain level of management, and if you want to design for the universal eventualities, then yeah, you end up with very wide roads, very everything wide and big and over-engineered. But if you start being clever about it and manage it, then you can actually get away with much less space. And I can translate it in English.
I won't
but not French.
I won't test my German tonight. Thank you for your presentation. Since you had the opportunity to observe Masdar for a year, what would you suggest might have been done differently after watching it for a year?
No, didn't say anything. It's now tricky. It's very hard, actually, to just say what would have done different. Yes, personally, I stand behind the concept in the first place. But a big lesson learned for me was basically the overall framework in which the project is sitting. So there is the authorities and so on, and basically that the authorities start to understand that actually what we are trying to do is also sometimes in the good for the authorities, for example, utilities and all that, because right now, and that would have been maybe, that could be something quite interesting for Abu Dhabi, when you see it like a pilot project where a city can start exploring new ways of how to do things, because right now the utility authorities basically building very wide roads. I don't know, it must be the best place for traffic planners, because like, I don't know how many traffic planners there are in this room, but basically all streets are dual way with the median in the middle. It's like that standard there. And then you have very often highways and then roads and roads till you come to the buildings actually. So it's extremely wasteful. And I think what may be sometimes a bit missed is with the understanding of the authorities, then when you look at it a bit closer, and if you take that as a model and investigate it really, let it happen first and see and take the conclusions out, maybe it might help evolving the policies of the city as well. But having said that, actually it is already happening. Abu Dhabi has established now its own building code or building system like LEED or PRIEM. And they said, Abu Dhabi said, okay, LEED is for America and it's well done there, but it's not good for us. We need to have something which takes care of the local requirements. So the Urban Planning Authority in Abu Dhabi actually did a great job, and I actually think it did one of the most comprehensive rating systems in the world, which is called Estidama, where certain knowledge from master has actually already flown into. The whole question of creating shade for people, not be wasteful with the whole irrigation, all that stuff, is basically now in a building rating system in Abu Dhabi, which is done by the authorities and which is compulsory actually to do. So where I said first that I would wish that there are more lessons actually coming out of this project and go more into what business as usual is doing, because that flow can also go the other way. Abu Dhabi actually is doing that and using some of the lessons to implement and improve its own codes.